information in this. And the problem was I could barely get past the 1950s when it was so packed. So I stripped material out of them. I'll be constantly saying it's not on the sheet, but you should know because it's something I shouldn't have stripped out, but I did. If there could be two other items before number 16, they would be technology and investment capital. You don't have to write those down. I'm going to talk about them, but you won't be tested on them. But if you put investment capital and technology along with labor of 16, favorable legislation of 17, business consolidation of 19, all of those things together are factors which led to the explosion of industrial growth in the United States in the Gilded Age. Gilded Age being 1877 to 1900. Welcome. So this is a period when the United States will economically, not necessarily militarily, but economically surpass European countries. And there'll be kind of an interesting identity crisis that goes with that. As Americans outproduce and technologically advance past Europeans, Americans will still feel like they are culturally having to genuflect to the cousins across the water. So that even though Europeans are early learning from Americans now in terms of industry and inventions, the attitudes will still be this haughty attitude that Europeans will hold, and this kind of like a stepchild, but kind of a removed, wishing to be recognized cultural attitude that Americans will have, which lasts up until mid-20th century. But anyway, again, we're putting this all together. Advanced technology, numerous inventions, of which things like, Thomas Edison, who's remembered for such inventions as light bulb and motion pictures, and Xerox technology first comes from his discoveries. Record players, motion pictures, these are things that are all Edison inventions. There's just a host of a large number of things that come out of the United States in this period. And investment capital also, which comes from the discovery of gold and silver out west. Between 1848, when gold was first discovered in California, and by the start of the 20th century, when you look at all the wealth that comes from western states, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, California, etc., gold and silver together, there's about $500 million worth of precious metal mined out of the ground. And that's not paper money, that's not anything that's inflated, that's hard currency which can be placed in deposits back east, and then you can print 10 to 20 to 100 times paper money on top of all that. So that's, I think, the biggest factor to why the United States surged forward in industrial growth is this discovery of precious metal. And what, if you heard this in the first half of the class, the irony of it all, I mean, irony, just is that it was discovered in California just 2 weeks after the treaty that transferred ownership from California to Mexico to us took place. Had there been no war, or had it been discovered earlier, the Mexicans would have been less likely to negotiate for that change in turnover. Maybe all that industrial growth would have been Mexican instead of American. So what makes things like that happen? Is it just random chance, or do we have a mission to take democracy all around the world, or what? I hear that tonight in speech. So that was what I wished I could have said, but took out before number 16. Another very, very important factor for industrial growth is surplus labor. Surplus labor, why? Why is surplus labor so critical for industrial growth? More people than there are jobs. Yes, labor, less labor costs. When there's more people than there are jobs and the labor costs are low and the profits are high. Now, that may not be for the laborers an immediate benefit, but for society in general, and that's probably a touchy comment, but it is true because if it creates a surplus, windfall profit margin for those who own the businesses, that's going to translate always into more investment, more expansion, and then more jobs, and eventually higher paying jobs. And that's what comes about in the Gilded Age. First, Civil War veterans, many who returned home and did not want to stay on the farm or stay in the business that they had left their parents owned, either set out west to buy farm property or went into the cities to work in factories. But the even greater amount of labor surplus that comes is European immigration. And while I don't want to get too trapped into my own lecture here, I'm going to footnote myself. Up to number 40. If you have your number 40 out, which I probably don't either. Yes, it is. Number 40 is one of the last topics we'll address, and that is immigration, the so-called old and new immigration. Let me draw just a little bit from what's going on in here in this item. From 1860 to 1890, in that 30-year period, 10 million immigrants will migrate to the United States from northwestern Europe. After 1890, those numbers become even more impressive when they reach on an average a million a year from 1890 to 1920, or at least to 1915. What's uniquely important here is that after 1890, there's a pretty quick shift away from the source of where it's coming from in Europe. Because those first 30 years that's mentioned here, 1860 to 1890, is still the traditional northern and western European sources that had fed the United States prior to the Civil War. So Scotland, Ireland, England, France, Scandinavian countries, western Germany, Holland, etc. Those are the areas that feed in that first 30 years. But after 1890, because of specific elements in European history, there starts to become this greater outpouring of people from Poland, Russia, Italy, Lithuania, Greece, Turkey, Albania. And that's a distinctively different type of persons in regards to culture and religion and politics, too. And those are the people in those much larger numbers that, if we move back to number 16 on our first page again, are fueling this surplus labor pool. And it's coming for two reasons, not only because that Europeans have their own specific circumstances, but because factory owners go over to Europe and recruit people. They even make arrangements to help pay for the passage and set up temporary residence, not good residence, but temporary residence when they reach the cities of the eastern seaboard. So there's a real effort to keep these people coming in to keep labor costs down. Ellis Island, listed in item 16, becomes a famous landmark after 1892 as an immigration station in which so many people came through. Probably people in every classroom in this school and every workplace here can trace relatives back to Ellis Island at some point somehow. And the criticisms that you hear today were thrown at people back then, too, in regards to willing to work for less, drag down the economy, complaints and criticism that they don't plan for the future, that they, in despair, tend to drink and fight and become reckless with the little money they have, and that they are of the wrong religion and little accents and dress funny and eat strange food and never will become Americans and learn to speak English. All of that, same things you hear today, was thrown at the immigrants that came from southern and eastern Europe at the turn of the century. And somehow they all seem to assimilate. And so there's an opinion today that while there may be an even larger wave of changes occurring today, that those who believe that, I'm going to go out and get opinionated here, this is not on the test, but it's fine for me. If someone thinks that eventually there's going to be Spanish spoken equally with English, I don't think it's going to happen. And the reason, I mean, there may be a blend and a change that occurs, but I really think that the trend, if it follows the trend of before, that American society, that which is the dominant financial society, tends to scoop up and change the outsider, not the other way around. And where I first kind of became deeply thinking about this was in a graduate course where we did a research on German people in the 1770s who migrated to Russia. Recruited by the Russian government to help move up the steppes and grow wheat. And they stayed in Russia from the 1770s up to the 1870s, and future generations a century later made a migration to the United States because of opportunities and because of the changing attitude of the Russian government towards German immigrants. But the people who came from Russia a century later still spoke German, still had the same religion, still had some of the same culture. The only changes they had were those things like dress patterns and work habits that had come from living out in the plains of Siberia. And so when they came to America, they expected the same thing, that they would, for another century, keep their German language and German culture. And in each case that I studied, within the first generation of children, the children were speaking English without accents, refusing to embrace the culture and the habits and traditions of the family, upsetting the parents, but completely Americanizing. And my experience of teaching in Northside since the 1970s has been kind of similar with Asian immigrants and offended that those families who think they're going to keep their culture are doomed to failure. They're going to be changed to American. And the major reason is the freedom and opportunities. Russia didn't offer equal respect and freedom opportunities. America does. So the freedoms alone doom an outside culture from surviving, I believe, personally. And I don't know if I've already shared this with you, but my son put it this way. He's a Star Trek fan, I am too. And he said that American culture is like the Borg, if you know what the Borg is. That is, resistance is futile. You're going to be assimilated whether you like it or not. You have no choice. So whether it's turn of the century now or turn of this century now, outside cultures can't survive. Now, I'm also working a completely opposite theory, that there's enough outside cultural change that eventually America will not be the same America we've known, but it'll still be based on the same principles. It just won't be based on the same Euro-Anglo culture. So those are contradictions, and I shouldn't tell them the same way. But as it says here, more discussion later, so we'll get to that later. Item 17. Another feature, another factor in why industry grew so prolifically has to do with favorable national and state legislation, laws that were passed that helped promote economic growth. The best of those laws, the ones that were most effective, were high protective tariffs, which we'll look at in a future chapter, specifically which laws and which years. Are we familiar with what a tariff is?
Tax.
Yes, a tax on imported goods. Goods that come in. So who pays the tax? Well, that's a lot of answers to that, but who first pays the tax? The outsiders, yes. So if Japanese want to sell cars in our market, they have to pay a tax to get into the market. If they're going to make any profit off the cars, they're going to have to do what? Yeah, up the price of the car to pay for the taxes that they have to pay. And with the higher priced items, the theory behind the tariff is that people will do what? Either buy American products, or they may buy the foreign products and cuss a lot about it, but more likely they'll buy the American products because they're cheaper. So both consumers in America pay for the tariff in an indirect way, and so do outside shippers. So if we, the consumers, are paying higher prices, and the people overseas are paying higher to get it over here, who's benefiting? It would. Okay, let's go into that first before we talk any further. The theory behind tariffs is if the tariff is low enough, government can make some money. But if you hike those tariffs up real high, people just quit buying all kinds of foreign goods and then they don't make any money. So a low tariff, a low tax, raises more revenue than a high one. Most of the tariffs that were advocated in the time period we're talking about are higher tariffs, or at least Republicans advocated higher tariffs and Democrats lower. We'll talk why later. But what's the value of a high tariff if it actually means the government does not recoup any revenue? And then what, again, I mentioned how much more it costs for the consumer. Who's benefiting if the consumer is paying more? The people that own the businesses. They're making the profits by selling. And you could say, indirectly, and by the 20th century it's not so indirect, the workers who work in those factories. If they're having better jobs or higher wages as a result, you might say like factory workers in Detroit definitely are benefited by tariffs on Japanese cars. So in the 19th century, tariffs are, for the most part, promoted by business owners, but by the time you get into the 1930s and 40s, high tariffs are something that organized labor and unions want even more so than the business owners. So for the sake of businesses' wishes, however, the Republican Party was a strong proponent of high protective tariffs. Democrats were for lower tariffs, and maybe this is a time to go into asking why. Let's talk about the two parties to start with first, and then we'll get into where their position on a tariff might be. The Democratic, I'm always wanting to go back and do origins of things. I know it burns up a lot of time, but we're here for a whole semester. That's cool. Where does the Democratic Party get its start? You're working in the right time period. Today's Democrats... Actually, some claim that today's Republicans and today's Democrats both are birthed from Jefferson. And I guess there's some truth to that. The Federalist Party disappeared and Jefferson split later. But more specifically, when did they use the name just Democrats alone rather than Democrat-Republican or something like that? who was the first big Democratic president that was famous?
Jackson.
Andrew Jackson. So when the 1824 election was such a big mess, that party split into two halves, one half calling themselves Democrats, the other half calling themselves for a while National Republicans, and then they became Whigs. So Democrats start in the Jackson years of the 20s, and then the one you were working with around the 1850s is when the Whigs evolved into Republicans. So that's the origin. They're both come into existence before the Civil War. In terms of their ideological position, the Democratic Party, starting from Jackson, are the strong proponents of laissez-faire policy and states' rights. And that's probably a term we've mentioned for the first time, laissez-faire. Have we talked about that before?
Okay. And find some chalk. Now, everywhere you go, my classroom is going to, chalk is never bigger than that. There's some kind of conspiracy.
I don't think it's never bigger than that.
They're afraid we're going to run off with it. That's an I. Laissez-faire, French phrase. L-A-I-S-S-E-Z-F-A-I-R-E.
Probably. If really correctly written. What would this translate literally in French? Hands off, let alone, leave alone, let do. What does it translate, not translate, what does it colloquially mean in politics and government?
Less government, less regulation.
Yes, less regulation, less assistance, government staying out of the picture, both in a positive and negative way. So, for example, if you don't tax and regulate a business, that's laissez-faire. On the other hand, if the business goes under, you don't also give them a low-interest loan or a bailout. Same for people. Heavily regulate their lives, but you also don't give them assistance either. So that's what laissez-faire would mean in a business political situation. The Democratic Party was the early champion of laissez-faire. The belief is that if government, the best, in fact, it's kind of a hierarchy situation. The early Democrats under Jackson believed that at all costs, try your best to leave the federal government out of the picture. If a government must be involved, keep it at the state or local level. Best yet would be no level of government involved. Let the private market solve the problems. So laissez-faire has both an economic and a social meaning to it. In an economic sense, again, it means less regulations or less taxes, less assistance. What does it mean in a social behavioral sense to have a laissez-faire government? Well, let's work the opposite. Let's go back one time. If you're non laissez-faire, then what's your attitude?
Government
should be involved, maybe everything or maybe certain amounts. And economically speaking, that might, well, let's look at the early Republicans. The early Republicans were the non laissez-faire party. I mean, that may seem strange for 20th century thinking. We'll explain why in a minute. What are some examples of the early Republican Party being non laissez-faire? Yeah, wanting a national bank, wanting a high tariff, wanting money allocated for road or railroad building. The government getting involved or spending directly money to promote economic growth. That was an example of non-laissez-faire. Now let's go back to the question we were fighting. What would be a non-laissez-faire attitude in social behavioral things?
Everybody's trying to get their own.
Okay, the respect of liberty and free choice, maybe in a business sense, but if we can move out of an economic sense, I'm trying to, without giving away the answer, in a social, ethical, pardon? Of voting, you mean? Well, in that sense, the Republicans would be for enfranchisement. They would be, yes, using, in fact, it is true. The Republican Party pushed the idea for African-American vote, women vote. Most of those things were early Republican Party, far ahead of the Democratic Party. But I'm trying to get away from politics. If we don't answer in economics or in politics, what are their area of life? I mean, I know economics and politics make up most of our life, but truly we have a few minutes left for books and dirty movies and music. But it's social, ethical, behavioral things is where I was trying to get to. So in that respect, Democrats in the beginning and maybe still today, when they're laissez-faire towards ethical behavioral things, they are for what? Or claim they are, at least. Yeah. Don't restrict what's read, what's listened to, maybe what's smoked or ingested or whatever. No, I'm not one of those, but I'm just giving you a theory here. I'm not. I'm a poor example of that. Yes. And that might also be in regards to, like, in more current times, things like the abortion issue. Libertarians are really interesting people because they say they believe in less government in everything. Less government in economics, less government in social behavioral activity, less government in foreign policy. Libertarians stand back and say, you Republicans and Democrats, you're both contradictions. And they're right. And there may be some libertarians in here, so I'll watch my tongue. But one of the things about the libertarian thinking that always makes me nervous is, and not, they don't all talk like this, but every once in a while you hear someone say, well, go ahead and let the guns and drugs be legal because the idiots will kill themselves off. I'm not real comfortable with the incompassionate side of that thinking. Yeah, it's consistent. It's definitely less government consistent in philosophy, but I'm not so sure I agree with the thinking of it. So the Democrats, back in the 1820s, get back to where we're going, Hollis, was the party that was for laissez-faire both socially, ethically, and economically. The government that governs least governs best, as you had pointed out earlier, the Jefferson quote. And that became the hallmark of the party, so it's not surprising Democrats would be for lower tariffs, because a government that taxes less leaves it to free, open, private, competitive markets rather than assistance from government. Democrats would argue that this is special favoritism, and it was special favoritism that Republicans offered to businesses who are already on top anyway, so why should they be getting extra favors when they're the ones that are making the most of the way? So Republicans would be the opposite in this time period. They'd say, no, we need these tariffs. Yes, it does help the ones on top, but there's some zero value here. What's the value? Definitely, that's the right phrase to use. It trickles down because their profits will multiply 10, 20, 100-fold, more jobs and more profits, a country that is economically stronger all the way around. So therefore, and Republicans can trace the roots back to, as we said before, sponsoring a national bank, building roads, freeing slaves, enfranchising African Americans, enfranchising women's rights. And these are things that the Republican Party will brag about correctly. That they were out there using government to help promote everything while Democrats are just laying back and doing nothing. Now, you might be wondering, well, how in the 20th century did we get to the point where Democrats seem to be economically the big government interferers with high taxes and welfare programs, and Republicans step back and become laissez-faire in economic issues? They're still kind of intrusive on the social issues, but on economic issues, they lay back. Well, that vector or watershed event is stock market crash and the New Deal. From 1929 to 1932 is when America makes the gigantic shift to where FDR takes the Democrats, throws away the last vestiges of the New Deal, laissez-faire, and makes it the activist party. And Republicans, in response, since now the big government is hurting business rather than promoting or regulating at least, we'll start to move more laissez-faire. We'll talk about that more later. So, for now, all we need to know is that in the 1877 to 1900 period, Republicans favored high tariffs as a way of helping business grow. And there are other aspects of legislation, if nothing more than just preventing regulatory laws or preventing taxes that come out of government. The Senate was more beneficial to business than was the House of Representatives, and not surprisingly, it may be because the Senate tended to be more in the hands of the Republican Party, and the House of Representatives in the Gilded Age was more in the hands of the Democratic Party. Until 1913, how did the Senate and the House differ? Should rephrase that question and say, what in 1913 made the House and Senate more similar? Both were elected by popular vote. A constitutional amendment, the 17th Amendment, allowed people to elect senators. So it wasn't people electing them. Who was it? Martians? Yeah, it was state legislators. Yeah, state legislators originally selected our senators at the time of the Constitution. That was Mystic. I just got close and it fell over. I think it stopped. If somebody wants to switch this over, feel free. I'll let you feel it. Anyway, the Senate was originally selected by state legislators all the way up until 1913. Then during the early 20th century, during a reform movement, it was made popularly elected like the House. So what was the purpose of making the Senate elected by state legislators rather than the people? In fact, let me add something to that comment. And why do senators have to be older to get elected? They have to be, what, 30? 30, I think. The presidents are 35, the senators 30, and House members 25. Okay, and if you add the smaller numbers with the higher age, with the selection being in the hands of a step away from the people, what's... Yeah, you're making a more prestigious, exclusive... I'm looking for another word here. Higher body of more removed individuals. So the Senate tended to be purposely more elitist, I guess is the word I'm looking for. And it's not surprising that the Senate would also be more in the hands, or that's not the way to put it, but in cooperation with bigger business. And so at times the Senate seemed to be so bought off by government, or by business, I mean, that they were called the Millionaires Club. You didn't get to be a senator unless you were already quite wealthy or you were close friends of quite wealthy people. Really. It was just so much work then, I guess. You didn't see Barack Obama in the Senate in the Gilded Age. That's not going to happen. Jokingly, sometimes, like for example, the Ohio senator would not be called the senator from Ohio, but rather the senator from Standard Oil. Or a North Carolina senator might be not the North Carolina senator, but the senator from Duke Tobacco or something of that nature. So that gives you an impression here. Favorable legislation coming on purpose here at this time period. Another example of the use of law or legislation in a way that favored business is the number 18. And I find this one's interesting. 14th Amendment. And Paul, let me read 14th again. We never read 14th too much. Oh, I was building my test for us last night. And I was looking at a sample question put in there. And I thought, oh, I can't put that in there because I didn't lecture it. I remember to look at it, I can. So let me add a truth about the 14th Amendment so I can use this other question on the test. In addition to what I'm about to read you, the 14th Amendment has a provision in it that says, I think I dropped this hint in before, that if you engaged in rebellion, if you borrowed money, or if you have debts in regards to supporting the Confederacy, that all those debts are null and void and you're just S out of luck. There'll be no repayment of those debts. But you're not going to make profit off of treason. See, that's the 14th Amendment. So now that I've mentioned that, I can make that question on the 14th Amendment. Here's the major portion of it, though. We did this last time, but here it is again. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. And here's section 4, the one we were talking about. Let me read this to you because I enjoy hearing it. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for the payment of pensions and bounties for service and suppressing insurrections or rebellions, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in the aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss of emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. So all debts that were incurred in regards to rebellion, all loss of slaves, etc., that's gone. But the first part of the amendment is where I want to go with this. Let's think historically. What is the reason behind the 14th Amendment? What's the history? If someone asks you, why does the 14th Amendment say what it says? You can now say, so now I'm going to give an hour lecture on this one. You can do it here. In fact, while I'm on this, the best way to study for a test, take a family member and they can hear the whole lecture over again. just lecture verbally the whole thing to them. Two things happen. First of all, you find the holes in your material. You'll reach a point where you'll say, gee, I really don't know what I'm talking about, let me look that up, that you wouldn't have done if you were studying sign language. And second is, you get the gist of how the story goes, and you can pretty well start assuming cause and effect, not because you took notes, but because you had to reason it out as you explained it to someone else. So definitely capture friends or family and re-lecture all this to them. It'll strengthen the material. So you're doing that now. You got your family cornered, and you're explaining the 14th Amendment historically to them. Why did it come about? Yes, yes. To protect the rights of emancipated slaves from black codes that southern states had created. And even though civil rights laws had been passed, there was an understanding that way down the road, those laws could easily be overturned by a court or a new Congress. So by putting more teeth into the laws, by making them an amendment, freed slaves could not be denied equality by southern states. So the purpose of the 14th Amendment would, I would say, be historically to help the people who were at the bottom rung of the ladder of America. Look how it's going to get used here in number 18. As a result of the 1873 slaughterhouse case, which dealt with slaughterhouses in Louisiana, they argued that when states or the federal government, but in this case the state of Louisiana, tries to pass laws that regulate monopolies, that since corporations are considered legal persons, they get incorporated, they become literally in the eyes of the law a legal entity or a legal person, that to put special restrictions on corporate behavior that you would not put on other businesses or other people is to deny that legal person their equal protection of the law and due process of the law. Back to the 14th again, it says here, no state shall make or enforce any law or which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person life, liberty, or property without due process, nor deny any person within his jurisdiction equal protections of law. So if you regulate a monopoly, you put extra taxes on monopolies, if you try to break them up and make them sell off their holdings, that is unfair to that poor corporation, which is a legal person. You're denying that corporation its 14th Amendment rights. So an amendment that was originally created to protect the persons at the lowest rung of the social ladder in 1868, by 1873, just 5 years later, is no longer being used to protect African Americans. We saw how that's being thrown out, being ignored. Instead, it's being used to help the richest and most powerful in society. So that's favorable legislation, for sure. And we will see the use of the 14th Amendment to prevent monopoly legislation being enforced all the way until Theodore Roosevelt. In 1904, 1905, and 1906, Theodore Roosevelt will turn that on its head, and that's why he'll earn the nickname the Trust Buster, because he finally demands that courts address that from a different direction. And he also will appoint judges to the court that will rule in different directions. Well, 19, let's talk about, we've been hinting about these monopolies. In addition to surplus labor and favorable legislation and better technology, investment capital, another feature which helped businesses grow quickly were new tactics and strategies of consolidation, the creation of various forms of monopoly. Monopoly being able to control 90% plus of an industry. Monopoly doesn't always mean the only business going on. I mean, technically it does, but a monopoly can usually mean if you have of all those, 90% plus of monopoly. There's also a term called monopsony, I think it is, and that is defined as when there is an equal share of monopolists, like a three or four that are controlling there, and the railroads probably fit that. Oligopoly is another phrase that goes with that, meaning that a few wealthy control a whole industry. The various forms of monopoly building include, as listed here, pools, trusts, holding companies, and interlocking directorates. Pooling, the first form of monopoly business building, would be similar to today's cartels, like the oil cartels. Who is OPEC? Yeah, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And most of OPEC is what? Middle Eastern Arab nations. A very, very prominent fourth highest producer of oil, OPEC member yesterday said, we gringos can all go to hell. You heard that? Who said that to him? Yeah, Victor Chavez, who, when he went to the UN the day after Bush spoke, said you could still smell the sulfur of the devil being there. Kind of outspoken individual there. But Venezuela is a member of OPEC, and what's the purpose of the OPEC nations? Why does OPEC exist? Yeah, so they can fix prices and fix quantities and make sure that profit's high for them rather than for us. So it's a form of monopoly. How it differs from other monopolies is it's not one owner of multiple businesses, but it's all a voluntary association. So pooling in the railroad industry or carteling and pooling in the oil business today only works if everybody cooperates. If, on the other hand, Saudi Arabia feels like, and they periodically do, that they can increase production levels and lower prices and outsell all their competitors, they'll do so, which is why they're our buddies, because they do that quite often for us. So businesses in the beginning worked in pooling or cartel fashions. That was replaced by trusts. And a trust is not something I can easily define. Every time I look at it, I get confused. But the essence of a trust is you take a corporation, and then you take multiple corporations, and you incorporate all the corporations. You essentially have a trust. You take all the stock certificates of a given number of corporations and trade them in place, trust certificates, kind of like a trustee of somebody's money being saved. What you really have, though, is one company owning all the other companies through the trust certificates. And the pioneer in the trust business was John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry. You know, there were numerous other trusts in sugar and manufacturing and leather works, et cetera, but the oil trusts were under Rockefeller were clearly the best. And not surprising, it led to the first regulatory laws there in the number 19, the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, which we'll talk more about soon. Holding companies are another form of monopolies, and I'd like to address holding companies often the way presidents address press conferences, and that is, no questions, I'm gone. I can never tell the difference between a holding company and a trust. Every time I read it, it sounds the same to me. The definitions I hear are that trusts produce things and holding companies don't. But that doesn't make sense to me because they're in the same sense buying and trading stock. So another form of monopoly construction. Interlocking directorates. Usually this involved businesses being owned by separate stockholders, but hiring one set of management or managers to direct the policies of all the companies so that they, like the pooling or carteling situation, carve out market regions and decide how much to charge and how much to sell and produce, and with one set of management making all the decisions. It may not. Interlocking directorates came around after the antitrust law. Yes. Okay. An interlocking directorate is an arrangement where you hire one set of managers to negotiate company policy for a number of different independently owned companies. So whenever the oil prices go up real high or down real quick, and we're always saying they're all in working in it together, they're not now, but they used to do that. And they used to do it actually by hiring one set of management to make those decisions. Oh, they might be in it now. We just don't have proof of it. So we can feel it's conspiratorial. Most all of these tactics in time would be deemed in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And I want to get into this a little bit. Let me draw a little bit and explain, because I've got it down here, number 25, and I don't want to repeat myself too much. But let me read to you the words of the Sherman Act, passed by John T. Sherman in 1890. Ohio senator, whose brother you probably know, William Tecumseh Sherman, who burned Atlanta during the Civil War. Famous Sherman family here. Here is some wording from the Sherman Act that you don't have to write down. Just listen to it. It says, every contract, combination in the form of trust or otherwise, or conspiracy in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations is declared to be illegal. The Act also says, every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or combine or conspire with any other person or persons to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations shall be deemed guilty of a felony. Every contract, combination in the form of trust, otherwise or conspiracy in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations is declared to be illegal. And the Act also provides that every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or combine or conspire with any persons or persons to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among several states or with foreign nations shall be deemed guilty of a felony. It's almost word for word, the same thing over and over and over. That ought to be clear. It's illegal to be a monopolist. It's illegal to be a monopolist. And yet it won't be surprising when we get down to number 26 how easily courts and businesses will get around the enforcement of this law. So let's ask ourselves, why is this law being passed in 1890? Well, people are complaining. People are screaming that monopolies are charging high prices and delivering low quality and squeezing out, you know, it's the big box mart thing on Jib Jab, if you've seen that. Did we talk about the Walmart skit on South Park? South Park's horrible to watch. Don't watch it. But if you get to see the Walmart South Park, I'm pro-Walmart, so I like Walmart. But I mean, it's really good because it comes back to these ideas about is a monopoly beneficial or not. There's a lot who say they are. Rockefeller for sure said they were. The argument is that it standardizes production. Everybody's working with the same set of software. They're using Microsoft. That a monopolist can make multiple profit opportunities and take that profit and plow it back into research and development to provide more quality products, where if everybody in the competition is just barely getting by, there's no investment capital for improvement. So standardization, efficiency, these are all things that monopolists say are possible. But our country has been, by and large, real uncomfortable, legally uncomfortable with monopolies, and that's why this law was passed. Now, what's interesting is Republican legislation passed it. That shouldn't be surprising because Democrats are laissez-faire. They wouldn't be for government regulation. But at the same time, you know, Republicans are known for being friends of big business. So what it turns out to be is that Republicans satisfy people's demands by passing the law, then immediately appointing people to the federal courts who don't enforce the law. That's how that works. So they're still satisfying the people's demands for regulation, but protecting business interests by not enforcing the laws in courts. We in Italy are the only, if I'm correct here, I read this once long ago, but Italy and ourselves are the only two nations with antitrust laws. Japan tried it for a while under MacArthur's occupation. As soon as we left, they threw them out. Went back to letting big monopolies build. What's the rationale behind saying if you're winning in business, you got to sell it off? You worked harder than anybody else. You sacrificed, you saved your money, you reinvested, you took risks, you provided products for people. You finally succeeded in business, and now because you succeeded, you're told you have to sell off your holdings. Why do we as a nation do that? And I think it's a good thing we do, too. Yes, it's the use of government to restore a laissez-faire spirit. It's the use of government to restore competition. The belief is that when there are multiple competitive sellers and buyers out there, the best comes out at the best quality at the lowest price. And monopolies destroy the laws of laissez-faire economics. As long as you have multiple people involved in the competition, you don't need government. But once a monopoly starts to manipulate the market, the benefits of laissez-faire disappear. So in essence, to recreate a level playing field, government should step back in and establish such laws. So that's the theory behind it. But businesses really didn't have to worry about it because they said they wouldn't be enforced until Roosevelt's times in the early 1900s. Item 20. Between 20 now and down to 24, we're going to look at some of the exact industries in which these monopolists arose. The business that created the most profit, gave rise to the most wealth, was the railroads, not surprising because they by the lifeblood between factories and consumers and products out west, et cetera. These names all are associated with Gilded Age railroad prophets. The Vanderbilt family, Cornelius and William. Cornelius got his start in the early 1820s in the steamship lines. If you have heard the case Gibbons versus Ogden in 1824 that is related to the Vanderbilt family. Later invested his money in the 1850s into railroads, and his son, born into lavish wealth, William Vanderbilt, built the family profits up 11 times over what his father had done in the railroad industry. Gloria Vanderbilt, you've heard of her. Isn't she involved? What is she involved in? Makeup? Besides being rich and famous, clothing. She's the granddaughter of William Vanderbilt. Who is her grandson? Anderson Cooper of the Katrina CNN. Yeah, there's just a direct link there of their family. And when we talk about this noblesse oblige concept M22, that's Anderson Cooper has often alluded to that he feels a certain sense of family obligation to give back to society and do for society because of the opportunities his family passed down to him. Less socially conscious than that, however, are these names. Jay Gould, James Fisk, and Diamond Jim Brady, as well as James J. Hill. Those names, and I'll leave Harriman off for a moment, although he's almost as bad. These names were people who didn't have any social concern or responsibility at all. Their attitude was, there's money to be made in a hurry, and the people who don't make it as fast as we are stupid. And also their attitudes were, the more we show off the lavish wealth we have, the bigger the home, the more jewelry we dress up in, the more it teaches others that if they work as hard as we, they can make it. So there was kind of a post-Civil War new wealth attitude, which was kind of gaudy and arrogant. And those people come to be known as robber barons in item 21. So people who elevate themselves to some kind of aristocratic level, making their money off of the sufferings of others through monopoly businesses. Which may be an unfair characterization. Others say these people pioneered streamlined business techniques that others could follow into the 20th century. They should be praised as captains of industry rather than criticized. So that's a debate that rages. This last name in the railroad lineup, E.H. Harriman. Harriman was the one who owned almost all of the railroads in the Pacific Northwest, and he would be involved in the first antitrust suit that forced businesses to sell off. Had a son named Averill Harriman that was a diplomat and Democratic Party member throughout the 20th century and key instrumental negotiator in the Paris peace talks in the Vietnam War for Johnson. If you've watched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid movie, you remember that they are trying to rob the same train over and over and they use too much dynamite to blow the train all up. You remember when they're trying to get the door open, Woodcock, I think his name, refuses to open the door for them. You remember why? Yeah, he's more afraid of his own boss, E.H. Harriman, than he is the dynamite that they're going to use on him. And Harriman was so angry at Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid that he hired Pinkertons at a cost far more than he ever lost and what was stolen just to get revenge. That was the attitude of Harriman. So, is that us? Is that me? Am I hearing that? Okay. I'm the only one hearing it. I better watch what I'm taking. So what we come to here in item 21 is kind of a social question, and that is, do private property rights and liberty, is that so sacrosanct that even at the cost of social well-being, these people should not be regulated or taxed? Are we that hardcore laissez-faire that we have no desire or no need to limit their behaviors? Or does the commonweal or the well-being of the nation at some point in time say that there is a cap to wealth, there is a limit to action that should be placed on these people? That's kind of the question we'll be addressing as we go through here. 22, here are two concepts associated with this robber barons versus captains of industry thinking here. The wealthy people in America prior to the Civil War, from colonial days up to the 1850s, are markedly different than this new wealth that occurs in the post-Civil War period, in that they were just a lot more modest, a lot more humble about their wealth. I'm not saying they earned their wealth in any more honorable way. I think the Roosevelt family, if I understand correctly, made their money in the early 19th century selling opium to China. I hate to say that about Franklin Roosevelt, my favorite president. But the point I'm going at is not how they made the money, how they flaunted or didn't flaunt the money. There was an attitude among wealthy Americans that it was inappropriate to be ostentatious, inappropriate to be showy and arrogant. And that people in America who were wealthy believed they had an obligation to society, that they had this noblesse oblige, that the benefits of being successful are balanced with the responsibility of giving back to society. It is this new wealth that occurs in the Gilded Age, or Nouveau Riche, as it's labeled here in item 22, in which so many people seem to have no obligation to social well-being, an arrogant, aloof attitude, and aristocratic thinking. And so it may well be that the desire to tax, regulate, and bring power to bear on these people is not just because of the money they command, but the attitude they reflect. If they'd been more generous and a lot more sharing, probably wouldn't have been creeping socialism. In the steel industry, in item 23, the best-known name, of course, is Andrew Carnegie, or as he's properly pronounced, Carnegie, which I never say, but that's the family wants it pronounced that way. Carnegie is the classic rags-to-riches model. Comes from Scotland as a young boy. Pennies, or pence, I should say, British pence in his pocket when he gets here. Works in textile mills as a bobbin boy, threading the bobbins in the sewing factory, saves his money, astutely decides that the way to go in money is railroads, but not so much in railroad stock itself, but the steel that makes the rails. That's where he figures the future is at. And he didn't know anything about the technology of steel, but he was a good gambler in the markets, and so he made lots of money in the steel industry with buying stock, and became the first billionaire in America, selling most of his holdings to J.P. Morgan, the banker, turn of the century. And we'll say more about Carnegie and his attitude towards responsibility to society on the next page. But the primo monopolist, the best one of all, the champion, the national champion of monopoly building has to be John D. Rockefeller of the Standard Oil Trust, which is the heir to today's Exxon Oil. His way of creating monopolies was you've got to be the only game in town in every direction, not just in retail sales, but in each factor of production. So moving from the oil wells to the refineries, after refinery, onto the railroads, onto the trucks, to the outlets, you've got to own every single element of production, and you've got to own everybody's company. You either buy them out or you squeeze them out through cutthroat price dropping to get rid of them. So when we say 96% of the oil industry was in the hands of John D. Rockefeller, that's every factor of production as well as retail outlets. And Rockefeller was a big believer in social Darwinism, which is going to be discussed down in item 28. Here's a quote from your textbook in which Rockefeller defends his way of monopoly building from a social Darwinist perspective. We talked a little bit about Darwinism, didn't we, in social Darwinism? The belief that culturally and ethnically those who are superior have the right to squeeze out those who are not. Here's a quote from an older version of your book, page 837, but it's probably close to the end of the book you're in now. Paragraph. It says, accumulated wealth was the best evidence of fitness. Successful businessmen and corporations were the engines of progress. If small businesses were crowded out by trusts and monopolies, that too was part of the process. As John D. Rockefeller would tell his Baptist Sunday school class, the growth of a large business is merely the survival of the fittest. The American beauty rose can be reduced into splendor and fragrance which brings cheer to its beholder only by sacrificing the early buds which grow up around it. This is not an evil tendency in business. It is merely the working out of a law of nature and a law of God. So it's God's will that he become complete master of the oil industry and all the other small fries, French fries, churches. That's how social Darwinists thought. That's how Rockefeller thought. And that's what triggered the Sherman Antitrust Act, too. Exactly. That kind of feeling that at some point in time society has to be protected from these monopolists. Which is probably a good pause point. We'll pick up in item 26 with the first time the Sherman Antitrust Act is challenged in courts and how it's not enforced in item 26. So what do you say? Up for a quiz? You got enough? Okay, so the next time we come back, we'll take a quiz the first time. Oral quiz. It'll be 13 questions. You only need to get 10 to get a perfect paper. Go for proper nouns. If it's capitalized, it's probably the answer.